Hello and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. Russia and the West survived the Cold War because both recognized and practiced the concept of indivisibility of security. One country should not attempt to attain security at the expense of another country. This is exactly what the West has done against Russia, to the point of claiming Russia has no right to any security guarantees. Crosstalking security guarantees, I'm joined by my guest, Nebojsa Malich in Washington. He is a blogger and columnist. In Quebec, we have Dmitry Laskaras. He is a lawyer and freelance journalist. And in Worthing, we cross to Anthony Weber. He is an independent political commentator. All right, gentlemen, crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump in anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. Nebojsa, let me go to you first in the Imperial City. This idea of indivisibility of security has been quite lost ever since the end of the Cold War, because it was the hallmark of the Helsinki process. And NATO has just thrown that into the wind. And I would say that is the result is the conflict that we have in Ukraine. Though no one in the West seems to want to use that logic, but it was the West and the Soviet Union that came up with that logic that kept the peace in Europe during the Cold War. So what are they missing? Go ahead, Nebojsa.
Well, you are quite correct that this was what ended up preventing the Cold War from turning hot. Unfortunately, it was retconned from history in the 90s amid this whole end-of-history triumphalism that became the ideology du jour in Washington. And the Helsinki process basically became a conveyor belt for the U.S. to browbeat other countries into doing its bidding. And this doctrine that wasn't quite so clearly formulated, but that basically said that the only truly sovereign country in the world is the U.S., and everybody else has to do what they're told or else. And we saw what or else meant in 1999 when NATO proceeded to attack then Yugoslavia without any sort of, breaking the U.N. Charter, its own charter, the Helsinki Charter, all imaginable charters that it was privy to. And that was just basically, okay, we did it because we wanted to, and what are you going to do about it? And, 23 years later, we are where we are. It's one of those, obviously none of this would have happened had the West abided by the treaties that it signed, but that has really never been the case, has it?
Yeah, well, Dmitry, I mean, it was a few days ago that the German chancellor came out and said that, there has to be new security guarantees for Europe after the conflict ends in Ukraine, which Russia obviously, in his mind, will lose, which he's obviously wrong. But it's really kind of befuddles me, is that does the German chancellor know that those security guarantees were in place before NATO expanded? I mean, there's this sense of forgetting history. It's really extraordinary how the German chancellor could say something like that. Your thoughts, Dmitry?
Well, we have an overwhelming tendency in the West to have a short or non-existent historical memory, and we tend to choose the date, the starting point for history that is most convenient to the narrative of the U.S. hegemon, the United States government. And the fact of the matter is that it has been eminently well established by the historical record. In fact, it's beyond reasonable dispute, not only that Europe signed on to the notion of indivisible security and recognized that the insecurity of one state affects all others within the European region, something we're seeing today in a very vivid and painful way, but it's also absolutely clear from a historical perspective that the leaders of the Soviet Union and in Russia received assurances that there would be no expansion eastward of NATO. And there were repeated warnings from luminaries across the West, including George Kennan, including Henry Kissinger, including even William Burns, the current director of the CIA, that across the political spectrum in Russia, there was antipathy, entirely understandable antipathy towards NATO expansion, that there had been assurances given that the breaking of those assurances would have potentially catastrophic consequences for Europe and the West's relationships with Russia. And we simply conveniently forgot all of that because the United States decided that its status as the world's sole superpower was at risk and that it needed to take measures to weaken Russia. And then beyond that, to weaken what it seems to regard as its prime competitor, China.
Well, Anthony, almost exactly 1 year ago, Russia sent to NATO and to Washington two notes, ultimatums, whatever you want to call them, about, you know, it's, you know, basically they're up against the wall and you have to listen to us because the security architecture has collapsed. Is that be something that could be possibly entertained now? I mean, because we have mixed voices in Europe. You know, there's no relationship, no future with Russia. Then Macron, and he got criticized for it, said there has to be security guarantees. Your thoughts, Anthony?
Well, the problem is there's a huge amount of distrust, which has been caused by what's happened, because, as been rightly said, from the 1990s, when the Cold War ended, there were these assurances that there wouldn't be an expansion of NATO, even though they weren't in written format. But the problem is, since the end of the Cold War, NATO has really massively expanded, especially since the turn of the century. So it's been a complete sense of distrust there, because why should the new Russia trust people in NATO? But you also have to look at the situation. Obviously, any country needs to have some security, and the United States wanted security when we had the Cuban Missile Crisis. And you have to look at what the former President Gorbachev said, because he was the architect of agreements between the old Soviet Union and NATO, and he said, you may not humiliate a country and expect that there to be no consequences. And of course, there are consequences in respect of humiliating Russia, which is what's been happening now. But it's as though these agreements we had, the Helsinki, the structures we have in place to reduce tension, have been totally ignored, as you've said. And the voices for peace are shut down. And one of the objectives of NATO is supposed to be to protect freedom. But there's no freedom in the West at the moment about free and open debate on this whole issue. And is it really in the interests of NATO countries to have conflicts with Russia over Ukraine? And it clearly isn't. And we all have to look at our own interests from the UK country's point of view. There's no strategic or other interest in being involved in this conflict.
Well, yeah, Nebojsa, I mean, if there are going to be relations, it's going to have to be mutual. That's not a message that's coming out of European capitals. It's our way or the highway. I mean, it's really extraordinary that they don't reflect upon how we got here. They don't want to do that. And as has been pointed out, they choose their dates, okay?
Right. Well, the thing about European capitals is that I see a lot of rhetoric coming out of there, but not a lot of agency. Essentially, Macron and Scholz and others talk a big game, but they do what they're told at the end of the day. Now, who they're being told that by, you know, I choose to believe that it's not Joe Biden, because that would be even more humiliating than the alternative. But the problem with the collective West is twofold. One, they can't they wouldn't recognize their own interests if they, you know, literally fell in their lap. That's one. And two, they're not agreement capable. There's a very clumsy but wonderful Russian neologism that literally translates as not agreement capable. These are the people you cannot make deals with, because, and this is something the collective West has forgotten, and I'll put it in terms that pop culture terms that everybody can understand. If your method of dealing with people is to say, I'm altering the deal, pray I do not alter it further, you're the villain in this story, not the good guy. So, you know, this is a bit of self-reflection that's needed to be done in the West, and I don't see it in effect anywhere. I think Macron's passing thought about giving security guarantees to Russia, which is about a year too late, is the closest it's come to it. And he's been viciously attacked over that. And yet, you know, he's been censorious at home and banned any sort of criticism as you know, Russian propaganda. Same with Scholz in Germany. And they entertain these fantasies that, you know, once Russia will lose, things will go back to the way they were before. Well, I've got news for them. First of all, Russia's not going to lose. And secondly, nothing is ever going to be like as it was before, no matter the outcome of this current conflict, because that's not how these things work.
Yeah, and Dmitry, if Russia is not granted security guarantees, it will create its own. That's what the West doesn't understand, Dmitry.
Yeah, again, I want to come back to the point we made at the outset about the historical amnesia from which we seem to suffer in the West. We forget that the Soviet Union, according to a 1993 study of the Russian Academy of Sciences, suffered some estimated 27 million losses in the First World War, the Second World War. And that included approximately 9 million military deaths. Of course, these horrific casualties were inflicted upon the Soviet Union in the Second World War by an aggressive Nazi regime emanating from Germany. And I think it's
well,
to say,
and Dmitry, I just to point out, collective West minus the UK at the time. It's really interesting, okay, because you had the entire European landmass, okay, joining Nazi Germany. Keep going. I'm sorry to interrupt.
Well, obviously, this is a historical trauma of tremendous proportions. I mean, these losses that the Soviet Union sustained were vastly in excess of those of the Axis powers, the United Kingdom, the United States, and Canada combined. And yet we seem not to understand that this historical trauma affects the perspective on of the Russian people and the Russian government with respect to security, particularly on their Western border. And unless and until we come to grips with that reality, we are going to be at risk of interminable conflict, military conflict, with potentially disastrous consequences because of the risk of nuclear exchange.
All right, Dmitry, I'm going to have to jump in here. We're going to go to a hard break, gentlemen. And after that hard break, we'll continue our discussion on security guarantees. Stay with RT. Welcome back to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. To remind you, we're discussing security guarantees. Let's go back to Anthony and Worthing. You know, it's interesting that in the mainstream, it's verboten to talk about what we're talking about on this program here. And one of the things that's not talked about is that European security architecture not only excluded Russia, but was excluded Russia and was against Russia. And this is something that, if we're going to have peace in Europe, has to be rectified. And given the voices that we are hearing in Europe and in, obviously, Washington and London, we have a very long way to go, maybe a generational issue. Go ahead, Anthony.
Yes, that's very true, but we've got to recognize what the real agenda is here. And Tulsi Gabbard, the American politician, summed it up very well when she said the Ukraine war is all about regime change in Russia, and it's not really about anything else, and it's about globalist vested interests at play to bring about change so that the country of Russia plays the game in the globalist way. And we need to look at what President Putin said in 2000 about Europe, because he said Russia is part of European culture, and I cannot imagine my own country in isolation from Europe and what we often call the civilized world. So it is hard for me to visualize NATO as an enemy. So I don't think Russia ever wanted conflict or NATO as an enemy, but we've got hidden powers who have been trying to bring about this conflict between certain countries in the West and Russia. And it's interesting, it was only not that long ago that the United Kingdom members of the royal family were visiting Russia and improving relations between the UK and Russia. And now we have a situation where the former Prime Minister of the United Kingdom, Boris Johnson, is actively warmongering, encouraging the sending of more weapons and more aid to the bottomless pit of President Zelensky's Ukraine. And the UK and certain other countries have got blood on their hands, because a lot of the weapons which have been supplied to the Ukraine have ended up being used to bomb civilians as well as all the military casualties as well. But as you rightly said, we've got a problem that the mainstream media in the West and the UK as well is not allowing debate. So the public does not actually know the truth of what is going on. And that's a sort of bit of a sad thing, because NATO is supposed to have as objectives of securing peace, promoting cooperation, and guarding freedom. And NATO's doing none of those in the Ukraine and Europe as a whole.
Well, Nebojsa, I mean, Stoltenberg makes it very existential. You know, we must win. Russia must be defeated. Well, what happens when the reverse happens, Nebojsa? I mean, how does NATO survive this? Which I'm rubbing my hands with glee, because it's a failed alliance, and it's being proven.
Well, NATO's mission, according to its first Secretary General, who was a British peer, unlike Stoltenberg, who's an absolute NPC, said that the mission of the alliance was to keep the Americans in, the Russians out, and the Germans down. And it has been doing that, and it has been manifestly doing that ever since. The problem is that you cannot have European security without Russia. You cannot have, Europe with Germany suppressed. And obviously, American tutelage is turning out to be not really a blessing of liberty that everybody thought it would be. NATO is a failed alliance. If there is any justice in the world, it needs to be dissolved.
Yep.
It has manifestly served the opposite purpose of its official one. Again, Lord Ismay's definition worked out much better in that respect, but again, not to the interest of the people involved. I would argue that, Stoltenberg's in his infinite stupidity, and I'm sorry, I don't have any respect for this man. He basically admitted that NATO is a party to the conflict, even though he's officially insisting.
Right.
So, if you're not involved in the war, how can you win or lose? And if you are involved in the war, then welcome to the consequences. One big issue is that what we've discussed before is that it's not just historical amnesia. It is a very deliberate destruction of historical memory, to the point where most people in the West have this vision of World War II as seen on the silver screen in Spielberg movies, where the Soviet Union doesn't even exist.
Yeah.
Right. And I've been saying for the past few years, before this calamity happened upon us, that, give them another half a generation and they will have retconned that the Soviet Union is actually responsible for the war and even the Holocaust, because that's where things were headed.
Well, Nebojsa, I don't know if you've noticed, I'm a big fan of the World at War series that came out in 1974, I think it was. It's been completely erased from YouTube. I think there's one episode. And they've wiped it because of exactly what you said, because it would keep the memory of the war, authentic memory. Dmitry, I mean, where NATO has drawn a line in the sand. I mean, how does it survive when it loses in Ukraine?
It won't. It's credibility.
Good. Okay.
I find it unthinkable that NATO will survive in any meaningful form. Perhaps some rump of NATO, confined to a core of states in Western Europe, might survive this disaster from a reputational perspective. But NATO's in this sort of existential crisis because it staked its credibility on total victory in Ukraine, which from a practical perspective is unachievable. Quite apart from that, NATO's credibility in any rational world would have taken a massive hit well before the commencement of the special military operation in February, because, for example, NATO committed extraordinary trillions of dollars of resources, apparently, or certainly in excess of $1 trillion to the war in Afghanistan. And over a 20-year period, was unable to vanquish the Taliban, who were largely armed with Soviet-era small arms. NATO, in the name of human rights and the doctrine of the responsibility to protect doctrine, which it's abused shamelessly, effectively destroyed Libya, which was at that point in time, up until that point of time, the most prosperous state in Africa. NATO bombarded Serbia, and even to this very day, that problem hasn't been resolved. It's festering, and there could be war in Kosovo. So when you look across the spectrum of NATO intervention, what you see is one failed state and one disaster after another. And on top of that, you have NATO demanding, clamoring, Stoltenberg and others, that every NATO member spend 2% of its GDP on the military, whether there's a legitimate need for them to do so, and whether, even though there are pressing domestic issues that every member of NATO has to confront, including poverty and environmental and the environmental crisis we currently confront.
You know, Anthony, one of the things that's very curious in this propaganda-rich environment, that this is an elite war. Because if you look at polling, if you dig down, most people are interested in domestic issues here. But this isn't an elite agenda.
Yeah, yes, it definitely is. And, you know, we just had comments about the record of NATO, which has been one of failure. In fact, the one instance where they could have succeeded, Afghanistan, they totally betrayed 26 million Afghans, human rights, education standards for women, and so on, simply because they did a deal with the Taliban. They never lost a major battle with the Taliban. So they conveniently left Afghanistan to get involved in the Ukraine. But we have got a sort of wider picture here. And it's all very sad that other people and events are controlling what is happening. But we have to do our best to, in all the respective countries who are involved in the Ukraine, to encourage our governments to exit from those policies. And
but that would be appeasement, Munich. That's all you hear. That's all you hear. And you know, to all of you, the people that say that don't even know what it means. Okay, it's a slogan. It's simply a slogan.
They didn't say that about the deal with the Taliban, did they, Peter? So it's all double standards.
Well, of course, you know, Bush, I'm glad that Afghanistan was brought up here because Ukraine is the new grift, okay? Because Afghanistan was a 20-year grift. Now this is a new grift.
Yes.
Well, it is. The problem with this is that obviously this is a much bigger grift for the weapons manufacturers, except that they hoped that, you know, their whiz bangs would actually get the job done in 3 to 6 months. They're the ones who were hoping for a short victorious war, and it hasn't been that. And now they're facing the cold, hard reality that their production rates cannot possibly compete with modern warfare. And also, Afghanistan was a typical Western expedition war, something that happened far away that didn't really impact anybody at home aside from those poor souls who came back with PTSD. This is having immediate consequences, not just for Europe, which is obviously directly impacted with the energy collapse, but even in the U.S., because, you know, the Biden government tried blaming the gas prices on the conflict. So here's, for the first time in God knows how many years, certainly in the West's living memory, a conflict that's actually hitting home, however indirectly, and the population doesn't like it. And guess what? The population doesn't get a vote. It doesn't matter how hard they're put upon, because nobody cares what they think. It's let them eat cake all the way down. And it's absolutely destroying any sort of delusion that might be persisting in the West about some sort of, you know, government of the people and democracy.
Let me jump in here. Dmitry, last 30 seconds go to you. How is the West going to accept defeat in Ukraine?
Well, my great fear is that it won't.
Okay. Yeah.
That speed is full speed ahead. They don't know how to de-escalate. Now we're talking about sending Patriot missiles to Ukraine. Every single reaction to a Russian intervention in this theater of war is one of escalation. And I think at some point, we as a people are going to have to take matters into our own hands, get out into the streets, and demand that our governments finally engage in a process of negotiation and de-escalation.
Yeah, a little bit of democracy wouldn't be a bad thing right now, gentlemen. You know,
things are happening already, Peter.
Yeah. Well, you know, that's one of the biggest casualties is democracy and listening to what people have to say. Gentlemen, fascinating discussion. That's all the time we have. Many thanks to my guests in Washington, Quebec, and Worthing. And thanks to our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time. Remember, Crosstalk Rules.